I'm going to do this like, what's my line, sir, if you would verbally sign in. I know you're not old enough to know that show.
I am, yes, I completely am. I think Walt Disney was on that show once. Yes, so this is Don Hahn. I'm the producer of the opening night film High Ground.
Not to be confused with the Stevie Wonder tune Higher Ground.
Yes.
That's a different movie.
Which I like as well, but it's not the same.
What's really cool about the opening night festival is the angle of for the troops.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people don't associate military with cinema.
Yeah.
At least not, you know, we think of war films, but this is a really excellent idea for a theme for an opening night festival as far as saluting as well as opening a door to a whole new audience.
Yeah, well, that's why we made the movie, which is I don't have a military background or a family in the military, but I have a filmmaker's background, and I thought I can bring those tools to play with you know, this film and tell a story, or more importantly, hold up a microphone and have our veterans tell a story about what they're going through returning from war. There's been plenty of war movies, plenty of great movies like Restrepo that talked about the experience of war, but we felt like there wasn't a great movie about returning from war, and this is, we hope, that movie.
It's like, it's not First Blood, it's not Gordon's War,
no.
Dead Presidents. I mean,
you realize with a lot of these guys, and they say so in the film, that the challenge of war is not the war itself. It's the hardest thing about it is coming home. Because in the war, you have your task, your marching orders, you have your colleagues and your comrades, probably the best friends you'll ever make in your life. And those all go away when you come home. And then what?
It's a combination of that. And I always think of the scene in the Hurt Locker, where he's in a grocery store.
It's heartbreaking.
Overwhelmed.
It's
unbelievable.
And that's what we found with the 11 veterans in this film that we took climbing in the Himalaya. They come home, and it's the same thing as a Hurt Locker. They're standing there going, I've lost my friends, sometimes literally to death,
correct,
sadly. And some of them are suffering from physical injury, and most from some sort of post-traumatic stress or traumatic brain injury. And it's something that in past wars we fumbled this ball, you know, most notably in Vietnam, and I just didn't want to do that again. So hopefully this film is certainly not going to solve the problems of the world, but will open a dialogue.
Correct.
And I was so happy, honored, and I thought how smart of Heartland to pick this movie, not because of the movie, but because of the subject matter, to shine a spotlight, as you said, on these issues.
I always think of George Carlin, who talked about when it went from shell shock to post-traumatic stress disorder, and trying to almost kind of blanket a condition that's not universal, but it's been around since the beginning of
time
of war. So
yeah, in the Civil War, they called it Soldier's Heart. And then they had It's a song title. And then, and then shell shock and battle fatigue.
That's right, battle fatigue, yeah.
And now it's post-traumatic stress. They've even dropped the disorder off of it.
Oh, well, yeah.
So, to be totally politically correct. So, to go totally George Carlin. but it's a fascinating issue.
How did you find the guys?
Well, I had met Michael Brown, the filmmaker, who's an extraordinary director. He has climbed Everest 5 times. I have trouble climbing out of bed in the morning.
Denver's a challenge.
Exactly, yeah. I know. The altitude in Indianapolis is really getting to me right now.
Hey, wait, we saw the mountains in Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Exactly, yeah. So here's a man who's a mountaineer and a filmmaker. So first of all, we had a great director. I met him. He said he was doing this shoot of these veterans. There's a great organization called Soldiers to the Summits that sponsored the climb. It was also a mountaineer named Eric Weinmeier, who is the first and only blind man to summit Mount Everest, is in our film and on this expedition. So Eric, along with Soldiers to Summits and all these World Team Sports and several of our sponsors, wanted to get together and take vets on a climb. And so we had sometimes caseworkers, sometimes hospitals, sometimes the vets themselves had heard about it through the internet, and we had a kind of a trial process. Many people dropped out, and we ended up with these 11 kids, I call them, because they're in their 20s, signed up for the climb. And with them, we took a team of Everest summiters that helped Eric Weinmeier summit Mount Everest. So you have this team of veterans, this team of Everest summiters, and we had one Gold Star mom along who was really a champ and ended up trekking with us. And we just followed that journey, knowing that something interesting would happen. We thought something interesting would happen physically on the mountain. Somebody would get sick, somebody would fall, God forbid. But what happened most interestingly, and it comes across in the movie, is the psychological change that goes through these kids when they go to Nepal and kind of leave their battle wounds behind. And the camaraderie of climbing is so much like the camaraderie in the military that they experienced. It was kind of a healing journey for everybody. So that comes across in the movie, and it was a big surprise when we were making the movie.
And I think when we talked earlier about war films, I think, you know, especially in features, there is a point of view in one way, shape, or form. And I think even with some documentaries, because, well, even documentaries have a point of view, regardless of holding up the camera or not.
Yeah.
And was battle, was war, was that ever brought up when they were climbing, or was just they were not a mission, but this was they were at the task at hand?
Yeah, I mean, certainly we interviewed all the vets and they talked about their battle experiences, but we didn't want to make a movie that had a political point of view, because that's been done a million times, and it gets boring, frankly, after a while.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen a lot of movies that are anti-war or whatever, and that's not what this is. We wanted to make this pro soldier and follow that soldier where in his boots or her boots to the battleground and coming home again. And so regardless of your political point of view or your point of view even on war, these are extremely loyal people, extremely loyal to each other and loyal to their nation and loyal to their branch of the military. And seeing them come home and carry that loyalty with them, sometimes in the face of, you know, the government turning their back on them or getting, you know, not great care at institutions or whatever, is really heart-wrenching, and it makes us remember that we have to take care of these people who ultimately have taken care of us,
right?
You know, militarily.
Yeah, I was stressing over which turtleneck to wear today. So
exactly, yeah,
yeah, there's nothing happening. But also, and as far as, and you also have a sense of adventure with the climb itself.
Yeah.
It's not the old. We go back to putting the camera sideways for Burt Ward and Adam West to climb up. Yes, of course.
I love those guys.
But you also have, besides for a documentary, you also have a sense of adventure.
It's a real climb.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real climb. In fact,
and it's a real climb.
Yeah, that last half hour of this movie is literally climbing a 20,000 foot peak called Mount Lobache in the Himalaya, with altitude sickness, with all the things that go along with it. And we had our Michael Brown, our director, and our film crew all over the mountain at base camp and all up to the summit, filming all the different episodes that went on. And without spoiling the end of the movie, we had everything you could possibly imagine, from altitude sickness to people dropping out to people making it to people not making it. And that drama was a great metaphor for how people come out of war. You know, you have people struggling and people some summiting and some not making it, and it just was a great kind of tie into the theme of the movie somehow. So it's an unusual movie that way. I think it's a thrill ride of a movie just as a climbing movie.
Correct.
But it also has this great subtext to it.
Now, how did the crew prepare for this? Did they go through a special training before?
Yeah, I mean, the crew is largely from Colorado. Michael lives in Colorado. They're all experienced mountaineers. We had apprentices and students along also, so they covered it. Very lightweight camera equipment. We shot on Canon 5Ds and smaller cameras along the way. Although Michael has experience shooting IMAX, you know, he's used to shooting IMAX Everest movies and climbing Everest strapped to, you know, a giant camera. But training not only for the crew but the soldiers as well, because to a vast extent none of these soldiers had climbed before. So you're talking about, here's a crampon, here's your ice axe, here's how you control a fall, here's how you're roped together, and what to do in certain conditions. So it's genuinely dangerous. It's not just a pretend movie.
Right.
They have a kind of life and death threat just climbing this mountain. But I think that challenge is what ultimately pulled them together as a team and helped a little bit with their re-entry into civilization again.
So there you go, Mall Crowd. You can see a thrilling documentary that happens.
I'd like to think so, yeah.
Now, as far as the opening night, tell folks what's happening with the opening night festivities.
Well, I've been coming to Heartland for close to 20 years and have always loved this festival because it really celebrates great filmmakers, and in the past they've opened with a fictional movie, a narrative film, and so tonight's the first time we're opening with a documentary, and I applaud that Heartland's been able to do that. So tonight at the Art Museum, one of the best theatrical venues in the States, and certainly in Indianapolis, we're showing the movie and doing it also as a tribute and a salute to our men and women serving in the armed forces. We have some of the stars of our movie, some of the military from our film will be there. I'll be there, and Michael Brown, our director, will be there. And it's just a chance to applaud the men and women in our service and to show in our film the kinds of struggles they go through re-entering into, you know, their life in America. So great night tonight, great celebration, again, not just for this movie, but for our veterans and our local veterans groups here in Indianapolis.
One of the great things about this festival is that you get to see a film that, you know, you might, if
exactly.
you're lucky if you can find it on disc or
find it on
a documentary channel, I guess. What is the festival afterlife for this film right now?
I'm glad you asked. It's true. It's very hard to find distribution for these films. We've been lucky on this one, though, because we have distribution. Through Warner Digital, who is offering it streaming. It's coming out in theaters across the country November 2nd.
Okay.
And then just a few days after, on November 6th, it'll be everywhere, available for purchase on DVD or Netflix or Amazon or wherever you shop for media. So watch for it November 6th. And we've had some amazing good fortune. We've sold it into places like Walmart and Best Buy, who are buying thousands of copies of it. So there's this, I think, hunger on people's part to see not only an uplifting film that's not all, you know, horror and the horrors of war, we know that, we've seen that movie, but something that helps us understand the problems of vets. So we've been very fortunate with this movie that the reaction's been good.
And I think in an odd connecting way, Act of Valor, you know, kind of opened door a little bit.
So. I agree, yeah. It's those kinds of films that are, they're inspiring to me and all of us, and those are the kinds of films we try to make.
So what's next on your plate for you, film-wise?
Wow, I have a really unusual career because I normally make big movies for Disney, and right now I'm working on a movie called Maleficent with Angelina Jolie. It's a retelling of the Sleeping Beauty story,
mm-hmm.
and she plays Maleficent, the amazing kind of evil queen from that Sleeping Beauty story, with Elle Fanning, who plays Aurora.
Ah.
And we just wrapped that in London last week. So shooting's done. We have about a year of post-production and visual effects, and it comes out in March of next year. And then I also produced the Disney Nature movies. So most recently, Chimpanzee, I think, was probably the last one.
Yes.
And now we just announced we've been shooting a movie on grizzly bears up in Alaska. Just finished shooting this summer, and we have another 2 years to go. But so we're filming bears, and they're the most amazing, crazy, salmon-eating, you know, hibernating characters on Earth, and
well,
cute as can be.
My kids' film correspondent, she wanted me to tell you pandas.
No joke. Pandas are adorable. The trouble with pandas, though, is they, like koalas, who are also adorable, they sleep all day and wake up at night and eat some eucalyptus and go back to sleep again.
So they're actors.
They don't do much. They're actors, basically, without makeup and a trailer, yeah. That's what's great about the nature movies. They're always in their spot.
I assume with the bears, there's less Timothy Treadwell.
Yes, yeah, a lot less people.
No, and no Werner Herzog narration?
No. It's just simply about bears. I love those movies, though, because we tell stories. You know, they're environmentalist movies, but we're not preaching to the audience. We're really trying to tell stories.
And the visuals and the access.
Oh, my God.
Amazing.
I was just in Bristol, England last week, actually. We opened Frankenweenie at the London Film Festival last week, which is a film I've been working on for 7 years. And our filmmakers are the same guys that did Planet Earth, the amazing BBC series, Discovery Channel series. And they were showing me some of the footage from this bear movie, and it's just stunning. And the state of the art right now, shooting with 4K cameras and helicopters and all that stuff up in our own country, in Katmai National Park in Alaska, mm-hmm. is pretty stunning to see the footage.
It's funny because we're used to computer graphics and making, you know, creating the background world.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, with a throwback to showing something I know they just showed on Fathom, Lawrence of Arabia. You know, and so it's kind of a return to, if you just look out your backyard or you're looking at your country, you look out, not just the landscape itself is beautiful enough as it is.
It is. It's funny. I'm a big fan of computer graphics and special effects, but somehow as an audience, we sense what is real. And I don't know why, because computer graphics are brilliant. And
they've come a long way.
They've come a long ways and are going further. But when you see something like Lawrence of Arabia, and you think, somebody sat on that horse and rode for 2 minutes into the camera just so we could see that shot, and somebody endured that desert for a summer and built that train and all that, it's stunning. And it's kind of the same with his nature movies. You think, oh my God, nature is yeah, you can build it in a computer, but how much better to get out there and actually see it.
That's why it's kind of fun during the credits where you see the crew, you know, preparing, and this
yeah,
is what
and
they
it's
do.
Brutal.
And
it's brutal. You
should have the Jackie Chan outtakes where you know, falling from a tree. And
I know. It's tough in any case to make a movie of any kind, but these nature filmmakers are just endure all kinds of awful infestations and diseases and things to go out and tell a story for us, which we make them go through. So,
what do you watch when you're at home? What have you been watching? Last time, can you think of the last film you were able to just crash down at home? And
it's funny. My wife is a huge old movie fan, so we're glued to Turner Classic Movies, and we watch a lot of old films. We were actually watching a silent movie the other night, and it's just amazing how much those guys knew of, you know, well before we ever figured it out. You know, they really understood picture making and image making and storytelling for the camera in the, you know, in the 20s when they first invented the art form. And so I love that. And I'm a big fan of documentaries, but I also love, I haven't seen it, but I can't wait for Argo to see it, because I love movies that are smart, that don't talk down to the audience, that have a sense of of reality and challenge the audience to go along with you.
Correct.
I love Inception for that way and those kinds of movies.
It also helps that we call this grown-up movie season now that the summer's done and we're...
It is. And, you know, God bless the summer. It's good. And I've released many movies successfully in the summer. But grown-up movie season, it's like... it's what Charlie Rose is to the Kardashians.
That's why it's such a breath. They're like, oh, if we could find a great movie in February or in August.
Yes,
you know?
And we wait for those moments. So to see movies by Wes Anderson or by, whomever... Ang Lee, coming out right now. I can't wait. And I haven't seen a lot of these films, but it really is a time of year when I look forward to seeing these.
And I always tell people, it's like there's... I know people say it's a good year for film, it's a bad year for film, but I've always had the impression that every year you're going to find Rembrandts, and every year you're going to find Dogs Playing Poker.
Yeah.
It's just the Dogs Playing Poker opens on 3,000 screens.
Yeah.
If the multiplexes aren't doing it for you, go online, go to the art cinema, find those films in August, in February.
I couldn't agree more.
And if that isn't working... Go to the archives,
I really agree. We live in a boom time for not only documentaries, but for film restoration. And I can sit down with my iPad and say, what do I feel like tonight? Werner Herzog. I'd like to see his movie on cave paintings in Lascaux. And you can dial that in and watch it immediately. What an amazing gift for not only filmmakers and audiences, but for young students coming up and being able to study that stuff. And as you say, going to the archives or just seeing something that's come out recently, you can see it on the airplane, on your cell phone.
And as a dad, with a child, my daughter's 10, if she needs to be in the car for a couple of hours, she's got a piece of a laptop or a phone. Now, of course, I told her I banished her from watching any David Lean on a computer. That's where I draw the line.
If she can only watch my movies, I'd be mighty grateful to you.
It's a part of it. Don't worry.
Thank you.
I'll photograph the library and show it to you with little marks on them.
Yeah, so. I would appreciate that. No, it's true. Like, my daughter is going to Art Institute up in Chicago.
Okay.
And she has a film class, so she's watching North by Northwest. She's watching these movies and understanding it. So I can have a conversation with her. She's 20 years old. About Hitchcock or about who Martin Landau is and those kinds of things, and she knows.
Well, I can. My daughter's 10, and she will only do it with me and nobody else in the room. But she will do Martin Landau doing the rant on Karloff and Ed Wood.
Oh, brilliant! That is a gift.
I can't really share with anybody.
No, but I would know.
Exactly.
It's funny, we had Martin Landau in London last week because he does a voice in Frankenweenie.
He's so good.
And I had lunch with him. It's like having lunch with the Pope, with all due respect to the Pope. Martin Landau has been around. He worked with Hitchcock. He's worked with De Niro. He started the Actors Studio with Steve McQueen. He still runs the Actors Studio in Los Angeles. And all I said probably one word, which was, Martin, tell us about
tell us about sitting at his feet, right?
And the stories are endless and really inspiring, because you realize everybody from Hitchcock on down has struggles and doesn't know what they're doing at times and tries things that fail, and it's so encouraging to know that everybody struggles no matter who you are.
And he's a great symbol of a working actor. The guy has done
working
everything
actor.
from Hitchcock to dreadful, dreadful. And he, you know, he's also one of the good. He'll tell you if it was, you know, schlock or dreadful.
Yeah. So I love that because it shows. A lot of times we feel like the motion picture industry is glamorous and it's, you know, it's fashionable and all that stuff, and it is. But the real movie industry is a working person's industry. It's damn near a blue collar industry.
Yeah.
And I love it for that. I love it for that because when you talk to Martin Landau or Angela Lansbury or James Earl Jones or any of those people that we admire as actors, they are working men and women, and they have learned their craft as anybody would have learned their craft.
Tomorrow's show, I'm replaying an interview because Diane Rehm interviewed him earlier this week, but F. Murray Abraham.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I'm showing my daughter Amadeus for the first time because he's and that's a guy he's able to. He does the movies so he can do the stage, and those actors as well that go from stage to screen to TV.
But look at Amadeus, the interesting filmmaker. You have Tom Hulce at the beginning of his career. It's one of my favorite movies of all time.
Milos Forman was able to make that.
It's an amazing, amazing movie because of those performances.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for your time.
It's
really,
my pleasure.
Really appreciate
it's
it.
It's great to be here.
I would love to heck, I'd just come and talk about old movies with you.
Happy to. As long as they're animated, I can talk about them.
Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
Pleasure.